We get used to hoods when we're quite young. You can probably remember mom saying, "It's getting cold out here. Put your hood up." We get a lot of comfort and warmth from hoods. But we also get some foreboding. Hoods have also been worn by executioners and Ku Klux Klan members and other scary people. We get a surprisingly detailed look at the significance of hoods in the book simply called Hood by Allison Kinney. It is one of the little books in the series called Object Lessons, an exploration of everyday objects that we often take little notice of. Christopher Schaeberg is the editor of the series. Allison Kinney's writing has been published in Paris Review Daily, New Republic, and the New York Times, as well as the journal Hyper Allergic. She's got a Vapo Rub story we can get into. Allison Kinney, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me and Chris on your show.
You bet. And Chris Schaeberg is an assistant professor of English at Loyola University, New Orleans, and the author of The End of Airports, We Wish. He's the co-editor of the series with Ian Bogost. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Thank you.
So a book series about the hidden lives of ordinary things. Chris, tell us about how this object lesson series got started.
Well, as you mentioned, I write about airports, and I've had this fascination or maybe obsession for, well, I don't know, 15 years or so. And so I wrote a book about airports, and then my editor at that time, this was in like 2012, he suggested that I propose a new book series for my publisher. And originally it was just a very modest idea. Oh, little beautiful books about single things. And then I started collaborating with my friend Ian Bogost, and he had his idea to merge this with The Atlantic, and it just took off. And it turns out that a lot of people wanted to write short books about and essays about just simple overlooked things.
So, Allison, that comes to you. What appealed to you about the subject of hoods?
Well, I think hoods fascinated me because everybody wears them. Babies wear them. Presidents wear them. People who are revolutionaries or opera singers. And so they're an ordinary part of our life. But as you said earlier, they are freighted with so much baggage and meaning in different contexts.
And the initial vignette in the book is about Bobby Rush, U.S. representative from Chicago, in the House chamber, put his hood up. And what happened to him?
Oh, yeah. This was happening after the murder of Trayvon Martin, and he went out on the floor and gave a speech about not demonizing people who were just going around wearing their hoods and minding their own business, and calling for some accountability on the part of law enforcement and government, and recognizing that, you know, citizens are just going about trying to live their own lives. And he was escorted off the floor. He was shut down and made to leave. And so he was considered to be in defiance of the rules about what's appropriate dress in the House.
Wow. As if he couldn't have made the point a little better than that, right?
I know, right?
Truly. Chris, how choose subjects for the books with Ian Bogost?
It really depends on the authors coming to us with an idea that they're just burning to write about. Ian often likes to say, you have to be really bonkers about something to write this kind of book. They're not exhaustive cultural histories, but neither are they just toss off like, okay, I guess I could write about tea kettles. You have to really want to write one of these. And usually we can see that in the pitches we get and the proposals. And as with Allison's Hood book, there was something burning that had to come out in this format, these beautiful little books that can hopefully reach a wide audience.
So what instructions do authors, other than the book needs to be slender and 4x6?
Well, it has to be smart and well-written. Those may seem rather vague, but I think you can tell when you open these books that they're both of those. I think for me, one of the appeals of the series and something that I love about it is that it really, it's wide open. We're far less interested in reproducing a certain form or format of writing, and just to see what can different kinds of writers bring to this size book about one thing.
Well, and here again, it's surprising how much we learn about hoods and in this particular book called Simply Hood. Allison Kinney, right from the table of contents, it seems that hoods made people wary through history.
Yeah, I think that wariness has been, you know, it's been tracked in a number of places and times, but right along with the wariness has been the fact of people just wearing them because it's cold out, because they have patchy fog, or because they have a blizzard to deal with. And so along with the wariness, there is the fact of people who are just wearing them because that's what people wear. And that ambiguity between fear and anxiety and people just minding their own business and trying to stay warm is what the book is about.
And you've already pointed out the ubiquity. We wear them from the time we're infants until we get into the White House, as this president has done. No mount hood in the book, though, you say, huh?
No what, sorry?
No Mount Hood.
Oh, no, there's no Mount Hood. There are no stove hoods or car hoods. Yeah, that you'll have to wait for a sequel for to get those.
Right. So startling revelation number one in this small book, Hood, death, now portrayed as hooded, was apparently not always portrayed. So what'd you find out there, Allison?
Oh, I looked through a ton of images from various art histories of Western European art. And what I found was that the Grim Reaper didn't wear a hood until around the 16th century. And so the Grim Reaper would just go about with his scythe naked or wearing a little bit of a shroud or just gallivanting around. And then in the 16th century, suddenly we have this outbreak of Grim Reapers wearing black hoods. And so it's not an image that's been with us forever. And in terms of, I guess, world history, it's a new image. And yet it's so pervasive now that we... That image of death in the hood is new and everywhere.
Is it kind of like representations of Santa Claus? Once somebody draws him a certain way, that becomes like the way everybody draws him after that?
Yeah. When those images came out in the 16th century, they went viral. They were pirated. They were distributed without the illustrator's permission. They just went everywhere.
Amazing stuff that we will learn about the hood as we go through the book Hood. Allison Kinney is the author. It's from the series Object Lessons, and that's from the Bloomsbury Publishers. And Christopher Schaberg is the series co-editor. He'll join us with the further details. They'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with you and your phone calls and emails when we come back to the Exchange in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about hoods, the hoods that you wear on jackets, on sweatshirts, on sweaters, you name it. They are a source of comfort, a source of warmth, a source of protection from the elements, but also have a lot of baggage throughout history when you start thinking about who else has worn hoods in more sinister capacities. The Ku Klux Klan is a good starting point. We get into all of this in the book Hood by Allison Kinney, which is part of the larger series of books called Object Lessons. It's actually a series of small books about everyday objects that we more or less take for granted, but that have fascinating histories and connotations to go with their denotations. Christopher Schaberg is the co-editor of the series with Ian Bogost, and he's our guest as well. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Allison, how far back in time could you find references to hoods in literature or history?
I'm sorry?
How far back in time could you find references to hoods in history or literature?
Oh, at least two millennia. There are some really fun images and stories of Romans going around wearing hoods. For example, there's a Roman man who was living in Roman Britain who had a hood stolen from him while he was taking a bath at the spa, and he left a curse note cursing the person who had stolen his hood and condemning that person to suffering and loss until he returned the hood.
Any note about whether the hood ever came back?
I hope so.
No kidding. There could be some really bad things that happened to the person who took it. So let's talk about some... we talked about the Grim Reaper and the fact that the death's representation with a hood only came from about the 16th century. Before that, not hooded, but true reapers in our time. There's a pretty good riff here on Florida's elaborate use of executioner's hoods. Can you give us a taste of that?
Yeah. It's interesting that we have an image of executioners as wearing hoods, black hoods covering their faces, this idea that they needed to conceal their identities. But that didn't really start to happen until the end of the 19th century and the start of the 20th century. And it has a lot to do with changes in capital punishment happening in a lot of places around the world in that time period. And so when Florida resumed capital punishment in the 1970s, they kind of reinvented the idea of a medieval hood that nobody in the Middle Ages had actually worn. And their executioner still wears this hood for executions. I called the Department of Corrections in the fall to say, you know, is your executioner still wearing a hood? And they said, yes. I mean, so this person is wearing this creepy, creepy hood in order to kill real condemned people.
But so, but the hood is based on a depiction that may come from, I don't know what, movies, TV shows, or something, but wasn't, as you found, factual back in earlier times.
Yeah, it wasn't factual. It was invented by artists, by movie makers, by people who were publishing books, who were all responding to a 19th century shift in capital punishment. You know, in prior to that century, a lot of executions happened in public, and then they were moved indoors into prisons, away from public access. And so we have this idea of execution crowds as being these bloodthirsty, drunk, you know, crowds who would make trouble. But removing the executions from the public view actually took them away from any kind of accountability to the public of, you know, responsibility of making sure that there was somebody who was being a watchdog. And so this idea of a creepy executioner who's presiding over everything was kind of a distraction from the fact that the public no longer had any access to the workings of justice.
Oh, so not even really necessary to hide the identity of this person from anyone, because nobody could really be in there.
Right. It was just a distraction. This whole idea of the executioner in a mask was a way to distract from actual politics.
So when you were asking the question of the Florida correction system about whether the executioner still wears a mask, did you get to the why?
Did I get to the why?
Yeah.
Well, you know, nobody would answer that question. They told me they really weren't comfortable talking about these things with
me. What a
surprise.
And, yeah.
And I had, you know, I found this out through a book by Ivan Zlotaroff on executioners who had done some reporting on this that was fascinating. And they didn't get into the why either. You know, they had this idea that it was somehow appropriate, that it was necessary to conceal an executioner's identity now. And I think it's possible that with various shifts in capital punishment in contemporary America, you know, we have different motivations now for concealing executioners' identities. You know, a lot of executioners have said on the record that they won't actually participate in executions if anybody knows who they are. So there's a shift now in culture that's very different from when we first started spreading these images.
Allison Kinney's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book in the Bloomsbury Object Lessons series is called Hood. We also have series co-editor Christopher Schaberg with us on the Exchange. Allison, the procedure for capital punishment is so clinical now with the stretcher and the chemicals in most places. Mm-hmm. And Florida's gone that way as well, hasn't it?
Yes.
But has the hood stayed even as things got sanitized?
Yes.
Wow.
And so that's a weird discrepancy. It's so suggestive in so many different ways, it's kind of terrifying.
Now, but there's also, it's not just the hooding of the killer, but also the hooding of the condemned. Does that still happen in most places?
Yes, it does. And actually, the history of hooding the condemned has gone on for a lot longer than hooding the executioner has, for centuries longer. So the fact that we identify in capital punishment the figure of the executioner as the one in the hood is kind of a mistake. It's the person who's condemned who usually wears the hood.
And what's the rationale, as if I couldn't figure it out for myself, but what is the rationale for putting hoods on people about to die?
I think it has something to do with the reason that hoods are often used in torture. They're a way of immobilizing people and also of dehumanizing them. It's harder for them to react, to show emotion, or to struggle. And also, covering their faces makes it easier for people who are going to inflict some form of violence on them, be it state-sponsored or not, not to see them as human.
Now, the term hoodwinked apparently comes out of executions. What did you find for the source of that?
Oh, I don't. Did I find that? I'm not actually sure that's what I did. I mean, you
there
might
was a reference to hoodwinking in here, yeah.
I did find a reference to hoodwinking with the founder of Quakerism, who was being attacked, and it was in fear of being hanged, and they were trying to put hoods over his face, and he refused. So I guess I don't know that that's the earliest usage of it, but it was an interesting one that I found.
Huh. I'm just struck over and over again by the fact that, you know, the hoods protect us from sun and rain, but also protect us from sun and rain and wind and all the elements, but also protect us from being known in a way that I don't think we get this weird about hats. And maybe it's the pointy part of the hood or something, but it seems like hoods carry just a whole level of psychology more than just putting anything else in your head does.
Yeah, you know, I at various points I thought about, you know, the difference between a hood and a balaclava, which has a specifically martial origin, and, you know, hoods and hoodies and hoods on anoraks, and, you know, a lot of people, since I started writing this book, want to come up to me and tell me what they think hoods mean, and I get so many interesting ideas from them. And often they want to talk about the sinisterness or the scariness of the hood. And these are sometimes people who are wearing hoods themselves as they're talking to me. And when I point this out, they'll say, oh, but, you know, when I put on a hood on my raincoat or on my sweatshirt, I don't wear it the same way other people wear their hoods. So that kind of goes, that's the heart of what this book is about. Why do we make these assumptions about why other people wear hoods? What meanings do we put on them that may have nothing to do with the meanings that people have when they put them on themselves?
Wow, there's just so much to think about here and a lot more to talk about. Christopher Schaberg, are you still with us?
Yes.
Okay, let's give Allison a moment's rest. Let's talk about the other recent releases in the Object Lessons series.
Well, in this most recent batch, we've done 15 books so far, and this most recent batch is 5 books. It includes Hood and Bookshelf by Lydia Pine and Cigarette Lighter by Jack Pendarvis, Shipping Container by Craig Martin, and Dust by Michael Martyr. And with each of these books, each title, we never know exactly what we're going to get. That's part of the fun of the series. With Allison's book, Allison wrote, as you mentioned at the beginning of the program, Allison wrote a great essay for us on the essay side of our series on Vicks VapoRub. And it was playful and smart and clever, and we liked it. So Ian and I often will, after someone publishes an essay with us, say, well, let's approach that author and see if they would like to do a book. And we never quite know if that's going to work out, but we thought we'd check. And Allison said, yeah, hoods. And Ian and I said, oh, yeah, hoods, that'll be fun. Ian and I both have small children, and so we thought, oh, yeah, hoods are great. You know, we put hoods on our kids every day. This will be a fun book. And then Allison delivers manuscript, and we thought, wow, this is, you know, quite a bit different than either of us had in mind, and it's exactly what this book needs to be. It's perfect in this way, and so many of the books have that that sense to them where the author, they knew what they were doing. They had something that they needed to get out about this object. Joanna Walsh's Hotel book has a similar feel, as does Brian Thill's book on waste. These are just books that you can tell were weirdly simmering in these authors, and it feels in some way like we just gave them an outlet for them.
It's, I have to wonder about, well, one of the other ones here in front of me is Silence by John Biganay. So you've got a book on silence and a book on dust, and they both run more than 100 pages. So you got people who are thinking pretty hard about stuff that the rest of us hardly ever think about at all.
Yeah, thinking hard about it, and also what I think, they're writing about it in a very accessible, eloquent way. They're not, these aren't heavy academic tomes that are going to sit in the back of the library. These are books that are meant to be read and that will hopefully unlock more thought in the readers.
They do indeed. I have to believe there's a double entendre to calling them Object Lessons, though.
Yeah, that name is funny. My publisher is Bloomsbury, and originally I was working with a smaller publisher called Continuum that had a book series called Guides for the Perplexed, which is also a religious allusion. And so with Object Lessons, there was this sense that, you know, these are heavy, important lessons, but we're kind of wresting that connotation out of its context and using it to be much more simple and just, well, what are the lessons going to be? What comes out of these things? And what how do they change the authors, too? How have these things imprinted on each author?
Interesting. So you bring Object Lessons back into the realm of denotation, but each of the books can go far off into the connotations of the objects that we're talking about.
Yeah.
We're talking to Christopher Schaberg, who is the co-editor with Ian Bogost of the series of books called Object Lessons from Bloomsbury Publishing. Allison Kinney is also our guest. She is the author of the book Hood, Newly Out, as part of the Object Lessons series, and we learn a whole lot about hoods here. You can join us on the exchange, 800-838-3760, with your thoughts on hoods and what they represent in our minds. 800-838-3760 by phone or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Allison, let's talk about a pair of murals you introduce in Chapter 2 of Hood, which is titled The Struggle Against Terrorism. What are the two murals about in Mexico and Iraq?
Oh, yeah, the one in Mexico, which I learned about through an art history article that was really amazing. It combines all of the symbols of the Ku Klux Klan and the Spanish Inquisition with the Holocaust, and it's incredible. And some of those, the shapes of the hoods and the images, get mirrored in a mural that was painted by a street muralist in Iraq who painted the image of hooded man at Abu Ghraib. And so when I saw the two of them together, I just thought, this is a chapter. This is everything that I want to say about people wearing hoods, whether they are torturers or victims.
Well, and when we get to talking about members of the Klan in particular, it looks like the figure of death in popular representation, members of the Klan did not always wear hoods either.
Right. That was so fascinating to find out that in the early days they wore Mardi Gras costumes, or they dressed up in drag, or they would put on straw hats and pretend, or party hats, and do French accents or make barnyard noises, or they would sometimes wear blackface, which is awful. I mean, everything about the Klan is awful, and then you find out that they went out in blackface, and it's even worse. And so finding that, you know, the Klan was not part of their standardized costume, that there was a time when they really were an invisible empire that was not centralized, that did not have a standard uniform. And it was scarier for that because they had no identity that you could recognize until they attacked you. And how this costume of theirs began, then changed and went through all these different stages until now it's an iconic symbol.
You know, I love the fact that you include this very mundane note to people who wear Klan hoods that they're adjustable.
I know. I found that on that Klan regalia shopping site, and it was like the banality of evil right there.
Yeah, it's sort of like buying flatter fitted sheets or something. You know,
it's just that
level of detail that you never even think about here.
There's
a great history lesson in here, too, that there were two spikes in Klan activity, the first after the Civil War, which subsided, as you point out, when whites regained political power and, of course, passed the Jim Crow laws. Do we really know what caused the second rise in Klan activity?
The second rise in Klan activity happened after about like 30 years after the end of Reconstruction. And so what you said there about how, you know, white Southern elites started to regain political control in the South after Reconstruction. Something that I talk about in the book is that is when lynching begins in the U.S., in the South, but also in the North. And so lynching is a phenomenon where nobody is wearing a hood because the people who are perpetrating these atrocities didn't need to. They had no need to conceal their identity. They were being supported by government and by law enforcement. And so they didn't feel a need to wear a hood to commit this violence. So then in after the film The Birth of a Nation comes out, and after Simmons, who was the founder of the second wave of the Klan, they come along in the 20th century, and they start reviving this, or reinventing, in fact, this Klan uniform with the face-concealing hood, because their target at first was communists, was immigrants, was Jewish people and Catholics. And they were not focusing so much on violence against African Americans because, you know, there was lynch law and there was Jim Crow and there were all these things that had so much sanction. And what they needed the hoods for was to brand themselves as a new clubhouse activity that would go against other people, so that they would be concealed in committing violence against other people that you know they might put them at more risk.
Wow, it's pretty amazing to look at that phase, the 20th century, early 20th century phase of Klan activity, because I don't know if you're aware of the fact that they pretty much controlled politics in Oregon, including the legislature, for a period of several years.
Oh, I didn't know about Oregon. I did know about Indiana, where they had a governor and a large chunk of the legislature, and they weren't actually brought down there until there was a horrifying kind of sexual assault and cannibalism story involving one of their members.
Yikes. Okay, things got a little uglier than they did in Oregon, it sounds like. You know, you bring up D.W. Griffith's film, Birth of a Nation, which I've seen and I still can't quite wrap my head around. Was he trying to say the Klan were the good guys?
Yeah. I think that's all, yeah. Yeah.
All right, there we go. The hoods on the Ku Klux Klan, one of many hoods mentioned in Allison Kinney's book, Hood, which is one of the object lessons book. We have more to talk about with Allison. She's the book author, and Christopher Schaberg is the series co-editor. Welcome back and talk more about Hood with Allison and more about the object lesson series with Christopher when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange. You're welcome to join us at 800-838-3760 over the phone. Or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Back with Allison and Christopher and you in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about hoods, you know, the thing you pull up off the top of your sweater or sweatshirt or whatever that keeps your ears warm and keeps the rain off your head, that sort of thing. It protects us from the elements, but it also protects us from being known by other people, which is one of the reasons it makes us a little nervous. We get into the whole realm of the significance of hoods, both psychologically and otherwise, in the book Hood by Allison Kinney, who's had her work published in a lot of places, including Paris Review, Daily, The New Republic, and The New York Times. Her book Hood is part of a series of books, all with the single titles like Silence and Hotel and Refrigerator and Waste, in the Object Lessons series, which Christopher Schaberg has co-edited with Ian Bogost. There are now 15 books in the series. Christopher Schaberg's with us as well. And you can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We touched briefly, Allison, on the Spanish Inquisition. Let's go a little more heavily there. They did wear hoods themselves, the Inquisitors, is that right?
The Inquisitors often wore hoods if it was already part of their clerical dress. But the white pointy hoods that we associate with the Spanish Inquisition were actually worn by the victims and not by the Inquisitors.
Really? And what did you find out about why those hoods were placed on victims? Is those like, almost sound like dunce caps or something?
Yeah, they do look like dunce caps. And there are various different religious traditions that involve those kinds of white caps that have nothing to do with the Inquisition. There's a tradition of, a lot of the victims of the Inquisition were Jewish people, and there was a tradition of putting Jewish people in white hats, either in paintings or in actual legal practice, to make them look creepy. And so seeing it pop up again in the Inquisition, it was a way of marking shame. It was a way of making them look not normal in a way that the hoods, the monastic hoods, say, that their inquisitors were wearing were made to look normal in,
Oh, so a soft hood means you're okay and a pointy hood means you're a weirdo.
Yeah, that's basically what it was. And then, you know, you suffer the consequences of that. But it's kind of arbitrary. And, yeah, that's what the book is about, the arbitrariness behind these decisions.
I hadn't thought that deeply about the clerical dress part of it, but then when you think about it, monks, certainly as depicted in medieval times, were hooded, but it sounds like that was probably more just to stay warm than anything else.
Oh, yeah. And there are so many examples that I found and, like, wonderful pictures of people just wearing hoods to stay warm or to look like everybody else, or, you know, sometimes so that they can just mind their own business and not attract attention. You know, they want to do their own thing. And, you know, back when I pitched this book, one of the images that really appealed to me was the idea of Star Wars, because everyone is running around in a hood in Star Wars. You know, you have the Jedis on one side, and you have the Sith Lords and the Emperor all wearing hoods, and it doesn't mean you're good or evil. It just means you're wearing a hood. And yet the image is so suggestive. But we've also got the Jawas who are wearing hoods, and they don't have any allegiances. They're not good or evil. And so even though Star Wars is such a, you know, it's a morally simple world, and yet this ambiguity is mirrors everything that has to do with how we wear hoods, too.
Well, that's right. Now, as you mentioned, Obi-Wan wears a hood, and
yep.
Darth Vader's got his helmet. But yeah, it's all kinds of stuff in there. The idea from the Spanish Inquisition of people passing judgment wearing hoods, it didn't stop with the Inquisition, and it sounds like in judicial garb, it's been fairly common.
Yeah, there are vestiges of hoods coming from the medieval clerical and academic dress that exist in judges' robes in a lot of places today. But I think where it really becomes obvious is in courts where the judges have worn black hoods over their faces so that they could be anonymous, such as in Peru. Or more recently in Iraq, there was a decision not to hood the judges because they felt that it would impede the transmission of an idea of transparency in the proceedings.
But is there, I mean, in judicial context, is it something like a conferring authority like a crown or a skull cap or a mortar board or any of the other, or wigs that the British judges still wear?
I guess so. You know, in the UK, there was this tradition of the black cap that was worn by judges when they were passing down death sentences. And it's you don't get to see that anymore, especially because, the UK doesn't have the death penalty anymore. But it's still part of the official judicial dress. You know, they carry it around on their person somewhere.
Mm-hmm. All right, so now again to hoods on prisoners. And we referenced the mural in Iraq that showed us the infamous picture of the person standing on the box with the hood and the electrodes and all that stuff. Is the purpose of a hood in that case to not let that person see, to not let the person be seen, or is it both? I mean, where does that go?
I think it does both of those things. It's humiliating. It's a way of lowering a prisoner's mobility. It also makes that person look creepy because of these associations that we have. And so it's interesting that not only the people who were in charge of working with the prisoners, but also some of the criticism that I read, because there have been so many pieces written about just the image of the hood at Abu Ghraib. But a lot of the people keep calling that hood a terrorist hood over and over and over. Even when they're trying to advocate for the person wearing the hood, they get stuck in that language and can't get away from it. So if even people who are advocating for that prisoner are calling it a terrorist hood, it says something about the power of the hood and why people might have put him in a hood.
Hmm. And it seems like the pointier the hood, the more terrifying the person or terroring the person.
Yeah, and you know, it was a sandbag. I mean, these are just plastic sacks that were put over prisoners' heads.
Wow. Jamie in Medford dropped a question off by phone, wants to know why we haven't mentioned Robin Hood yet. And you do in the book, so why don't you tell us what you learned about him?
Yes. No, I was hoping that there was going to be a section in my book on Robin Hood and class war, and it was going to be great. But then, you know, I read Ivanhoe, and I read a whole bunch of, like, medieval material, and Robin Hood isn't actually wearing a hood in most of this work. There's a little tiny reference to a hood in Ivanhoe, but that the disinherited knight is wearing, but not Robin. And you know, Robin, Errol Flynn wears a hood for a tiny little section of that one movie where he's on the balcony with Olivia de Havilland, but that's it. And so there's no hood. I mean, there's some fun hood stuff having to do with some Marvel Comics characters, but unfortunately, Robin Hood had to remain a pipe dream for this book.
Darn.
I know.
The name has to do. Yeah, there you go. Coming back to talking about in hoods in a torturer or aggressor or penal sort of context. I mean, there's a term in here, the weaponizing of hoods that you use, and I that bears some explanation, I think.
Could we break that down a little bit?
When you say the weaponizing of hoods, I mean, do you mean this in an Abu Ghraib context where, you know, this...
Yeah. Sometimes, like, for that context, I have a long section in my book on the uses of hoods in torture from World War II to the present. Well, from the Philippines to the present. And its use as a tool of capital punishment, its use for... terrorist violence like the Klan's violence. And again, I should clarify that even though the second wave of the Klan started out not targeting African Americans primarily, by the time the civil rights movement came in the 60s, then they became ferociously violent against Black Americans. Definitely in Abu Ghraib as well.
Okay, let's go make things a little lighter for a second here, because you get into hoods attached to bathing suits. What is a burkini?
I wanted to talk about people who are wearing their hoods so that they would have freedom, so that they could feel free with their gender expression, with physical expression, just to get around in space. And so the burkini is a modest swimsuit worn often but not exclusively by Muslim women who want to be able to obey dress rules but still be able to go out to swim and move around freely. And so there's a famous instance of a burkini that was worn by a young woman who was a lifeguard in Australia who put on her bikini to go out and save people who were being tossed around by the waves.
Wow. And what was the reaction to it?
She was working in a context where there had been a lot of racial and anti-immigrant tension in her neighborhood. And I think that people felt that her being out there and being part of the beach culture was a way to ameliorate relations in the neighborhood.
Allison, as I read through the book, it looks like you actually found an idea the first example of where hoods were attached to sweatshirts.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Champion seems to, or which used to be the Knickerbocker knitting company in upstate New York, seems to have been the first company, or they claim to be, to attach the hood to the sweatshirt and actually make a hoodie. And that was, I guess, back in the 30s.
Wow, okay, so not that long ago. We have a call here. Let's go to Mike in Eagle Point, Oregon. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Allison Kinney, who wrote Hood, and Christopher Schaberg, series co-editor of Object Lessons. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. The term hood, I think, is fallen out of disuse as a synonym for thug or gangster or bad guy, but it certainly within my lifetime it's been used that way. I wonder if your guest could comment on that derivation.
Yeah, let's give us a riff on hoods as hoods. Thanks for that, Mike.
Well, I think that the first usage of hood to denote a bad guy was in around the 1930s in San Francisco. And the Oxford English Dictionary doesn't really give the etymology of it is unknown. It just suddenly appeared in newspapers or, you know, books and various other sources of literature. So, it's 20th century American slang. And I talk in my book in the fourth chapter about the idea of what a hood is, meaning a person who's regarded with suspicion, and how this plays in with people who are wearing hoodies.
Christopher Schaberg, let's bring you back in here. I want to talk about the general thrust of where things go with the Object Lessons series. You mentioned you're at 15 now. Is there a number goal of getting to 20 or 25 or just whatever feels good?
Yeah, really, whatever feels good. I mean, we have another 15 books in the pipeline right now, and, well, actually we have about 60 proposals that we have to look at over the next couple months and make some decisions on. So it's been a little overwhelming and exciting, but we don't have a goal in mind. I guess the goal is just to keep doing it as long as there are authors and readers who find this form compelling.
Well, and I must admit, I have to believe you and Ian Bogost, your co-editor, are just as surprised as readers are. That's like, wow, you can go for a long time just considering the refrigerator or the phone booth or glass.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the fun things of the series is every day see what pitches come in over email or through our submission system, and just to see, someone wants to write about fog. Oh, someone wants to write about everything. So we just got a pitch the other day. Someone wants to write a companion book to John Biganay's Silence, called Noise.
Oh, that'd be great. But I mean, when you got to Dust, for example, I mean, some of these, have you just sort of wrinkled your face and thought, no way we could get that much out of this?
And it's always surprising which ones, it's surprising which ones really grab onto us or that we recoil to and then we just kind of warm up to. It's a really fun dialogue back and forth with the authors as these, you know, as you kind of home in on an object and then see what style or what approach are they going to bring to the book.
Mm-hmm. Allison, let's try to finish with a positive connotation for hoods. And I was thinking about the hoods that people get when they get graduate degrees. I mean, that's considered a good thing, right?
Oh, yeah. Those hoods are linked to the kinds of hoods that people wore in the Middle Ages to be clerics or to be members of the university. And so, yeah, there's a long tradition of people wearing hoods for prestige and celebration and all that, besides, you know, wearing them just to be ordinary.
Huh. It's amazing the amount of stuff you could find just about the things we think about hoods.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I found after the book was finished that I wished I could have put in was a picture of Princess Di as a baby wearing a hoodie.
Really?
Yeah, it's amazing. And so it overturns everything that we think about hoods.
Since I mentioned it briefly at the beginning, can you quickly tell us the why VapoRub has been a part of your life?
Oh, yeah, VapoRub. You know, I heard about the object lesson series, and I wanted to think about an object that kind of broke down the barriers between humans and objects and made us more open to the environment and also made us think about how we shut ourselves off. And you know, as a New Yorker who deals with a lot of noxious smells on a daily basis, you know, we kind of want our Vicks.
Just a little dab under the nose to kind of block out the rest of the stuff.
I know. It's like that scene in Silence of the Lambs.
Well, it's been fun talking to both of you and fun to read the book. It's just amazing, again, the amount of material you can get into a book that's barely more than 100 pages and about one subject, the hood. But Allison Kinney wrote it, and Christopher Schaberg with Ian Boghost edited it. Thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having us.
You bet. Take it easy. And that'll do it for today's Exchange. You can find out more about the program and subjects and suggest guests at jeffexchange.org. Check out the offerings on our Facebook page or follow us on Twitter at Jeff Exchange. If you're listening in the morning, The Takeaway is coming up next. If you're listening to our evening rebroadcast, we'll be followed by news from the BBC. The Jefferson Exchange is produced by Emily Curitan of JPR News. Emily Pfeiffer, our student assistant, is at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you so much for listening. Please join us next time on The Jefferson Exchange, and have a great day. Tuesday on the Jefferson Exchange at 8, the arthropod in the house. Hundreds of them, it turns out. We'll talk to an entomologist. Then Crater Lake mounts a defense against crayfish messing up the ecosystem. At 9, an annotated version of a classic, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, Decoded. Join us for Tuesday's Exchange and catch this morning's program again from 8 to 10 tonight on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio.